You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Robert Chesnut. Robert is the Chief Ethics Officer and former General Counsel of Airbnb, Inc., a graduate of Harvard Law School and the University of Virginia. He worked for 14 years with the U.S. Justice Department, where he prosecuted bank robberies, kidnappings, murders, and espionage cases. I want to get into some of that. He joined eBay in 1999 as its third lawyer, where he founded its trust and safety team. He joined Airbnb in 2016, overseeing a team of approximately 125 legal professionals in over 20 offices around the world. It is there that he developed a popular interactive employee program, Integrity Belongs Here, to help drive compliance throughout the culture at the company. He's written a new book with Joan O.C. Hamilton. It's called Intentional Integrity, How Smart Companies Can Lead an Ethical Revolution. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So let's do a quick check-in. That's what we've been doing since, you know, I'm recording at my home in Chicago on Zoom. You look like you're in your home.
I'm in my home. I'm hunkered down here in California.
Oh, that's nice.
Doing my best. Yeah.
Yeah. The sun finally came out in Chicago. It has been threatening to do so for some time. So I was both surprised and reassured by the optimism in your book, because it certainly feels like we're in a pretty dark place right now when it comes to the ethical behavior of our business and political leadership just in this moment. But you seem fairly optimistic.
I am, Kelly, and I think one of the reasons it seems a little dark right now is our expectations are changing. Mm. You know, the world is not willing to put up with the sort of thing that it was, I think, a lot looser about a few decades ago. You know, corporate misbehavior, you know, bad behavior by leaders was swept under the rug for so long, but then this thing called the internet came around, and that gave everybody a platform to start sharing their feelings directly and talk about this stuff. Yeah, you had Susan Fowler at Uber. Her blog post changed the direction of that entire company. So I think this is actually a sign that expectations are changing. We need more from companies, and the world's going to demand it.
So we should probably define integrity. I went to Merriam-Webster, and what they define it as is, quote, firm adherence to a code of especially moral or artistic values. Then there's a colon, and then in all caps, incorruptibility. I don't know if they're screaming that at me. So how do you define integrity?
Well, I'd take that, but I hate to argue with Merriam on this.
Oh, please argue with them.
You know, I don't think incorruptibility is a standard of almost perfection.
Right.
We as humans are not perfect. And one of the problems with integrity, I think, is that people are afraid to talk about it a little bit because they feel like they're not worthy. Like somehow that they can't talk about integrity because who are they to say anything about it? Because somebody might point the finger back at them. I think that you need to define your values. You need to define what you stand for. You need to commit to a path of living by those values, even when no one's looking, even when it's hard. But I think you also have to understand that you have to have the self-awareness to realize when you've gotten off track a little bit, because it will happen. And as long as you've got the self-awareness to admit it, and you're willing to then recommit to get back on course, I think you still have integrity.
So indeed, right? People are not good or bad. People do good things and bad things. We all do. And that's just a true thing that we've learned. I think science has told us that. Right. And then you write in the book, quote, although codes of ethics have many common themes, there is in fact no one list of rules that works for every company. So it's not just that human beings are different. It's that different kind of companies operate when it comes to ethics in different ways.
They do. I mean, I'll give you an example. Walmart. Yeah. Has a provision in their code of ethics about gifts from vendors. Mm. They accept nothing from a vendor in terms of a gift. And I mean, I've been in a meeting with a Walmart employee where if you give them a bottle of water, they'll hand you a dollar. And really the reason behind this very strict code is that Walmart's purpose and values are all around low prices every day for their customers. Mm-hmm. And they believe if their employees are getting gifts, even t-shirts, hats, or a cup of coffee, ultimately, that's reflected in the cost of goods that are sold to Walmart. That raises the price. So they've got one standard. Airbnb is a hospitality company. They're around helping people connect in a human, authentic way and get to know each other. And hospitality can include buying someone lunch or a cup of coffee or giving someone a t-shirt. That doesn't reflect that you are unethical by accepting a small token of hospitality. So Airbnb is a little looser. They'll allow employees to accept gifts up to $200, so long as, again, the purpose isn't to influence you improperly.
So I was thinking about this when I read that in the book, that I ran the box office at Second City around like 1989, 1990, and we would offer these dinner theater packages with a handful of the local restaurants in Old Town. And you're a fan of Chicago, so you kind of know what I'm talking about in that area. So I distinctly remember being invited to have lunch at one of these restaurants, which has since closed. And after my free lunch, the owner had me come to his office and he slid an envelope across the table at me.
Yes.
And after I stopped laughing, I slid it back to him. I never opened it. And I left. I went straight to our owner's office to tell him what happened. And the one mutual regret that our owner and I had was that I didn't look to see how much money it was.
It was
a very shitty bribe.
This sort of thing happens.
Yeah.
I had an employee at Airbnb recently who was given a baby gift when they had a child, mm-hmm, of a $2,000 by a vendor.
Oh, my God.
Right? And that's... and I don't know, I can guess what I think the purpose of it was, but look, that's not a way that you can do business. Mm-hmm. You ought to be doing business with somebody because it's the right thing for your company, not because you're taking money on the side. It's just wrong. And it's important for companies to define this and talk about it. So often, Kelly, codes of ethics are buried in an intranet. No one even sees them. No one knows about them. Or language is very vague. Do the right thing. Ambiguity is the enemy of integrity.
Yep.
Silence is the enemy of integrity. Mm-hmm. You need to define what you mean by integrity for your company and make sure everyone knows what the rules are so that there are no misunderstandings.
All right. I promise to mostly talk about the ethics area and in the book, but you do tell a story in the book about joining the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alexandria, Virginia, and an integrity issue actually involving a colleague of yours gave you a promotion and a pretty high-profile case fell into your lap, right?
That's right. I was a line attorney, and the attorney who was running the major crimes unit at the time was found by a judge to have withheld evidence that he should have turned over to the defense. I know the individual. I don't think he would ever do anything intentionally wrong, but it certainly put him in a very bad, awkward position and the office in an awkward position. So he had to be removed from that post for a while the thing went through its appeals. And I was given the position of running the major crimes unit. Within a month, the FBI came to me with a major espionage case involving CIA employee Alder James. And as a result, I ran the major crimes unit for 4 or 5 years and did a number of espionage cases, including the Ames case.
Wow. That is a legendary case, of course. And then you went to eBay early on, right, working for Meg Whitman?
I was employee 170 at eBay. Okay. One of the early employees. I was actually an early eBay user. I bought and sold some things while I was a prosecutor. I also had a hobby of involving photography, and was blown away when I went onto eBay the first time and saw how I could get all of these items that I couldn't find in Virginia near my office. They were available, and I could connect with people all around the world. So I started using the site, and I woke up one day and realized, hey, wait a minute. Maybe a company like eBay will have problems with fraud or illegal items or regulation. Maybe I could get involved and help. So I sent them my resume to jobs at ebay.com. They didn't have a job even open online. And I thought, well, I'll never hear anything. And I got a call the next day. Ended up working at eBay a month later.
I think it was really interesting because you quote, I think it was Meg who came up with describing eBay as a clean, well-lit marketplace, which is very good ethics branding, I think.
It is. You know, Airbnb, eBay, they're in the trust business.
Yeah.
You're in the business of helping two people who are total strangers feel comfortable sending an item, buying an item, doing a transaction together, or even living under the same roof. So as a platform, you've got to promote trust. You, as eBay, we didn't want to be seen as a back alley flea market where people were getting ripped off, where there's misrepresentation and counterfeits. We wanted to be a legitimate place to do business. That was the right path for eBay. Similarly with Airbnb, you know, we want to be seen as a great place to get to find a great place to stay and meet interesting people. So trust is at the heart of these businesses. So if you're going to build trust, you've got to operate with integrity.
So you started at Airbnb at a time where really they were having some trouble in the media in terms of this distrust issue. So that was an interesting thing when I saw that your book got announced. I was like, oh, wait a sec, because I flashed on the bad stuff. Certainly knowing once I sort of read into it that things had improved, and it's like, but yeah, talk a little bit about what you walked into when you joined the company.
Sure. Well, you know, Airbnb, it was a new model, a new way of doing business. And a lot of good came of it. But when, you also recognize that you're going to have challenges whenever you have that many people all around the world staying under the same roof. You've got issues, for example, like someone's house will get trashed.
Yeah.
Items will be stolen. When I walked into the company in my early, my first month, it became apparent in the press that individuals were being discriminated against on Airbnb because of the color of their skin. People were trying to get a room on Airbnb and were being turned down by host for racist reasons.
Yeah.
That was a very painful episode for the company and something that I had to work on in my first month or two at the company. So, I talk about in the book the challenges.
Yeah.
You know, like it was interesting as the general counsel of the company. Of course, I went off dutifully to do my legal work. Is Airbnb legally responsible if a host discriminates? Are housing laws even applicable to Airbnb? So I go off and do my research, and I go sit down and have my first big meeting with Brian Chesky, the CEO, founder of Airbnb. And I start going through with him the legal issues that were raised by this. And he put up his hand and stopped me and said, I don't care. I said, you don't care? What do you mean you don't care? He said, Rob, this isn't a legal issue. If this sort of thing is going on Airbnb, we are failing in our mission.
Mm.
Our mission is to connect people from different parts of the world and help them get to know each other and foster belonging. If this is happening on our website, we're failing as a company. I don't care what the law is. We're going to fix it. That was fabulous. As a lawyer, to understand that your company wants to do the right thing and act with integrity doesn't mean that you're perfect, doesn't mean that you've got it all figured out, but we had a North Star. And that was then the path that we went down.
It's a tremendous thing when your leader of your business chooses the integrity move rather than the financial move. And I've had that play out at Second City a number of times. I've worked with Andrew Alexander for 32, 33 years. And there was a number of places where it was like this sweet gig where they wanted us to censor this thing or whatever. And he was the first one to be like, walk away. That's not who we are. And this idea, and I want to talk more about integrity traps because you talked about ambiguity, which of course, and by the way, in improvisation, you can't also, ambiguity is the enemy of comedy. It's the enemy of improvisation when you're making up a script together. Silence, of course, you mentioned, but also incentives. That can really screw people up, right?
Sure. Well, how you measure success will often define how people will act. So if, for example, let's take Volkswagen. Volkswagen, as a company, put a ton of pressure on its engineers to come up with a vehicle that, a diesel vehicle that had, you know, virtually no emissions. And basically the CEO said, do it, or I'm going to find another group that will do it. Mm. So really threatened almost with their job, they came up with a plan. And the plan was design a car that fooled the emissions test, that made the emissions test look like it's a zero emissions vehicle, when in fact the car was still polluting the air. When they got caught, of course, it was catastrophic to the Volkswagen brand. You know, I used to think of the Volkswagen brand with such love, you know, the Volkswagen bug, the Volkswagen van and the like. I had a Volkswagen at one point, but my view of that brand was forever changed when I recognized that the company intentionally chose a path of deceit in order to sell cars. And that's something that the brand has a very tough time recovering from.
I had two Volkswagen Passats in a row, loved it. And then I had to get a new car about 2 years ago, and I went Accord, Honda Accord. I couldn't do it. And I imagine I'm not the only one consumer who felt that way.
Well, you know, a lot of companies operate in what Brian calls a 20th century thinking. What's for 20th century thinking for a company is very simply, you are thinking about one thing, and that is the shareholder.
Yeah.
Whatever is good for the quote-unquote shareholder, which is basically whatever is good for this week's share price or this quarter's result, is what you must do. That's an old way of thinking. That short-term, narrow focus is actually quite a selfish approach that will, over the long run, actually hurt the company financially. Where the world is evolving, and what I talk about in the book, the world is evolving to what's known as a stakeholder approach. Yeah. Companies do owe an obligation, an important obligation, to their shareholders and to the finances of a company. But they have other important stakeholders. Their employees are important stakeholders. At Airbnb, our guest and our host are important stakeholders. The world that we operate in, that's an important stakeholder. So when you make a decision at a company, you need to be thinking not just about your narrow short-term financial consequence, but what's the consequence going to be on the broad array of stakeholders that you have as a company? And you know, the fascinating thing, data shows this quite clearly. Companies that operate with integrity, who think about the broader stakeholders in the world, they actually outperform the selfish, narrow shareholder companies over and over again. So by doing good, you know, there's value in values. You will actually, over the long run, do much better financially.
Yeah, well, that follows in line with Adam Grant's work at Wharton. He wrote the book Give and Take, that givers do better than takers over the long run. Maybe
exactly
not in the short
right.
run, but over the long run.
I was just reading Adam Grant, Give and Take the other day, going back and looking at it. I love that book. And one of the interesting little pieces of data he shared was you look at two people who make exactly the same amount of money. One person gives $2,500 a year to charity. The other person gives $1,000. The following year, the person who gave more to charity actually makes more money on average, right? So what happens in the world is the more you think of others, the more generous you are, the more you recognize that helping others is an important part of the way that you operate, the more in a karma sense it comes back to you and the more people are going to want to help you. So there's a false choice, I think, between acting for the good of business and for the good of the broader stakeholder community. It's, you know, there, you don't have to choose one or the other. If you're a giver, if you operate thinking about multiple stakeholders, it will ultimately be good for your bottom line as well.
Yeah, at Second City, we talk about an ensemble orientation. And so the cast on stage is an ensemble, and they have all these rules, but many of which are sort of unwritten, where they take care of each other, and their job is to be others focused. But what we also recognize is we have bigger and bigger ensembles, and we co-create our work with our audiences. So we have to take care of them. And there's this very, there's a lot of sort of caregiving language inside our work in terms of improvisation, which is, I think, one of the reasons that it eventually made its way off the stage and into various boardrooms is because people also realized what the science is telling us now. Because 15, 20 years ago, I'm not walking into the University of Chicago and creating a program there. I mean, we did some corporate gigs, but not the level of sort of training that we're doing now, because it is an orientation that is different than our default orientation. Because our default orientation is to kind of say no or do nothing. That's all the work in behavioral economics. So the whole concept of yes and is to literally push you into those more uncomfortable areas. And that's the thing about, like, your gig, because you came over to Airbnb in the legal position, right? And
the general counsel of the company to start
with. Yeah,
right.
And then you took the much more difficult position of the way bigger hassle position of ethics.
What I realized is that if you don't focus on integrity and ethics, the legal problems multiply. If your company has integrity and operates with integrity, it actually makes the legal job a lot easier.
Yeah, they're kicking back.
Right, so I actually, as the general counsel, started focusing more and more time and energy on integrity because I realized it was the right thing to do for the company legally.
One of the things I love about this book is your emphasis on humor and storytelling. And you write, quote, "Intentional integrity does not have to be a cultural buzzkill." And then, "We have not declared a war on fun." Because I think, the first place people go with integrity is like, well, that's not going to be any fun at all. But in fact, I mean, you talk about how important it is to message with humor so those messages get received.
I think humor is such an important tool whenever you're trying to do anything in life. But there's no reason why you can't have a little fun with integrity. Brian was talking to me the other day, and Brian looked at me and said, one of the things that you've been able to do, Rob, is make ethics cool. And we have fun with it. And I'll give you an example of one of the ways we have fun with it. I was looking at the way that traditional 20th century companies operate. They use third-party videos to try to meet an obligation around dealing with sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And what happens? People just click through these third-party videos just to try to get them over with, because everybody knows you're doing it because you've got to do it. I was talking to my daughter, and my daughter looked at me and said, "Dad, nobody wants to watch a video for an hour. Everybody's wants to watch a 3-minute or a 5-minute YouTube video." And she actually pointed me to a 3-minute YouTube video on sexual harassment that had made a far bigger impression on her and her friends than any of these canned third-party things. And I realized that the 3-minute YouTube video had humor, it was short, it got the point across, and was far more memorable. So at Airbnb, we started creating our own 3-minute ethics videos. We would do one a month on a different topic. We'd have a little bit of humor. The acting was terrible. The script was terrible. I recorded it on my iPhone. There was no production value to these things whatsoever. We sent them out by email, and we didn't require anybody to watch them. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of the fact that no one was required to watch it, but it was only 3 minutes and it was funny, everybody watched them. And people want to appear in the videos. People write in ideas for the videos. And they become, nobody knows me as the lawyer at Airbnb. I'm the video guy. And everybody stops me in the hall and says, "When's the next video?" That's the kind of culture you want.
Yeah.
When people have fun with it and it becomes weaved into the place.
Yeah, then that becomes, that's the key, the participatory viral. About 10 years ago, we got approached by an ethics company about doing some live programming, and it didn't work out. In fact, they were very unethical. but then it opened the door to us to realize we created ourselves a video catalog called Real Biz Shorts. And basically, they're like even shorter. They're like 30 seconds to 1 minute long, funny videos, Second City talent, well-filmed. It's our, we got a production company. But what it does is it basically makes the journey through the more boring compliance training. And this is like data security stuff. I mean, some pretty thorny things that people need to know about, foreign dealings and bribes. And then we just have these funny videos that tee it up. And I think it's, now we're in our 10th year. We just announced a partnership with Ethisphere we were in quarantine and we knew we needed to make more. And so we're like, oh, animation. So we're releasing like 12 or 15 more because we figured out, well, we'll just turn this all into an animated thing and everyone's, you know, sending files around. But I really do. I think no one would ever think that Second City would have any place in an ethics and compliance conversation, which is probably the reason we should be there. I've decided this for the other, like, give me the thing that everyone thinks is the most boring or thorny or weird place for us to be. Probably that's a place that needs storytellers, artists, humorists to help tell the important tale.
We have orientation week at Airbnb. Yeah. All new employees have to fly into San Francisco and go through a week of training. 20 to 25 classes your first week. One of them is an ethics class that I personally teach to all new employees. And when I first went to the orientation group and said, we need to add an ethics element, they looked at me and said, Rob, there's no way. I'm not going to give you an hour on ethics. We're not trying to drive these people away their first week. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. I said, I think this is important stuff. And they do blind surveys at the end of the week where everybody can rate the classes. Number one ranked class at Airbnb orientation is the ethics class.
Nice.
Part of it is because the bar is so low. Everybody walks right into the room just dreading an hour with a lawyer on ethics. So if it's at all entertaining and engaging, people are going to walk out feeling like it was a huge win.
The other thing you talk about that's hugely important is inclusion. You write in the book, quote, if you don't get input from all parts of the company, you risk creating what I call the Moses syndrome. So explain for us what the Moses syndrome is.
Sure. The Moses syndrome is where someone goes off to the mountaintop to write all the rules about what everybody should do and then brings them down on the stone tablet code of ethics and imposes it on everyone.
Yeah.
Look, we operate in such a diverse world. Airbnb, for example, we've got offices in 25 countries. We've got thousands of employees with different religions, different cultures, different socioeconomic backgrounds. And the rules around the way that we should treat each other have to reflect that diversity. No one has all the answers here. What you need to do is you need to create a diverse group. And by the way, by diversity, I mean not just the color of skin or nationality, but people in sales, people in finance, people in customer support. You want a good group of folks that each has their own perspective, because if it's going to be something that really is your company, if it is your brand, it's got to be something that all of the diverse constituents have had a voice in creating.
We were talking about that sort of the 20th century rules, and another thing that I used to believe in, and I firmly don't anymore, is hiring for cultural fit. Because I think hiring for cultural fit means hiring someone who looks and sounds and behaves like me.
That's right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I hear people say, well, Rob, I've tried to find someone diverse for the role, but I just can't find them. And my response to them is, let's go to your LinkedIn profile. Let's see what your LinkedIn profile looks like. Because so often you end up hiring people from your network. Well, there's a tendency for all of us. Our network looks like us.
Yeah.
So if our network looks like us, and if as human beings we tend to gravitate toward people who are like us, it's no wonder that we end up hiring people that are just like us. That then creates a challenge. If I walk into a room and everyone looks like me, it's going to be a bad decision. Because what I need is I need different perspectives on a problem. I need people with different life experiences, people who have been through different things than I have, who might have very different ideas or approaches to a problem than I have, simply because they've experienced things that I haven't experienced. I think Airbnb, for example, recognizes, you know, the discrimination problem that we discussed earlier. One of the reasons that Airbnb had an issue with discrimination on its platform, Airbnb was shocked. People inside the company were literally shocked to hear that there was discrimination going on its platform. Part of the reason they were so shocked is that the company's headquartered in San Francisco, which is, frankly, a very accepting, diverse city. Mm-hmm. And many people who worked at the company lived in San Francisco, and frankly, the company was not very diverse. Mm-hmm. If we had hired more diverse people, we would have had people inside the company who would have looked around and said, hey, folks, there's a lot of discrimination going on in the world. They would know it because they had experienced it. Mm-hmm. Many of the employees at Airbnb back in those days hadn't experienced discrimination. So one of the things that we did when we were working on alleviating discrimination on the Airbnb platform, we focused on getting more diverse inside the company so that we would be more sensitive to these issues and we would be able to work in rooms with people who had experienced discrimination directly. And therefore, I think we were able to solve the problem, I think, in a more effective way.
Okay, so we're coming close to the end of the podcast, and I am going to ask you for like a yes and story, which we ask every podcast guest, a time in your life when you normally would have said no, but you said yes and, it can be work life. But two things I want to talk to you about before we get there. One is the idea around zero tolerance. I've had an uncomfortable feeling about that idea for some time, and because I get the idea, I broadly support this idea of protecting people, especially from, you know, sort of terrible behavior. But there, it's missing a nuance, right? That's the problem. Yeah, talk to us about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, my experience with the phrase zero tolerance is that it's a phrase often used by people in communications or by leaders responding to something bad that's happened. Mm-hmm. So when something goes wrong at a company, when there is a violation, an integrity violation, there's a knee-jerk reaction to come out very strong against it. And so often you hear the phrase, we will have zero tolerance for this sort of behavior. The speaking out against the bad behavior, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. And I respect that. But often in life, things get nuanced. Yeah. And in the ethics world, sometimes things aren't so clear. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can't use the phrase zero tolerance and a broad phrase like that and assume that you've therefore solved the problem. What you've got to do is you've got to dig into the nuance a little bit. So, for example, around sexual harassment, of course you want zero tolerance toward a sexual assault at work. Yeah. But by zero tolerance, do you mean that there should be no dating among employees in the company? Is it okay to ask someone out at the company? Is that sexual harassment? Or what about asking someone out, getting a no, and then asking them again? Is that sexual harassment? Mm-hmm. So I think what you need to do, it's easy to throw around a phrase like, we've got integrity, do the right thing, zero tolerance for bad behavior. The challenge is when you have to dig in, get specific. But of course, that's where the real value is.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, you say in the book, quote, ripping off the company can become a toxic and infectious form of bonding. That's scary.
Sure. Well, what you find sometimes with expense reports and people, you know, doing things using company property for personal benefit is, you know, sometimes people will say, well, they don't pay me enough anyway, so therefore it's okay. And then you end up grousing to your neighbor about it. But you know what? What we find is integrity is often defined by how we see others in our environment act. Mm-hmm. So if we believe that other people around us are doing something, then we feel like it's okay. So if I see that somebody else is expensing meals that really shouldn't be expensed, or taking things home from the company that they really shouldn't be taking home, then I assume it's okay too. And then you end up walking down this path where you end up with ethics problems. What's important is to establish an environment of ethics where everyone understands and believes that everyone else is following the rules. We all want to feel good about ourselves. And to feel good about ourselves, we want to feel as though we are as ethical as anyone else. So the environment is extremely important here. Ethics is contagious. A lack of integrity is also contagious.
I had sent out this email to a bunch of my academic friends basically saying, give me insights for what the world might look like when Second City is able to open its doors again. I theater people talk to other theater people. I want a bunch of scientists, nerds, to tell me what I should be thinking about. And this just made me think of my friend Dolly Chugg at the Stern School of Business, wonderful thinker. She said, always remember the 20-60-20 rule. And that's that 20% of the people are going to run back to your theater the minute they hear it's opening. 20% of the people will never go back into your theater. And 60% of the people are going to do what the other people do.
Right.
That framework seems like, oh man, I can apply that in a lot of different places.
That's right. We can be very influenced by others, and that's mm-hmm. No more. It's so true in integrity as well.
So we always end the podcast asking for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are getting together making something out of nothing, we do not get very far by saying no. In fact, we don't get anywhere. And we actually don't get that far by saying yes. That's sort of just like a blanket whatever. We yes and. We affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a moment from work or life where you kind of normally would say no, but then you're like, yeah, and I'll do this.
Yes. I think that careers are often made by being open to doing new things. Mm-hmm. When I was at eBay, I started as a lawyer. I was the third lawyer in the company. And after a few years, I was running North America Legal. And I saw my career as being a lawyer. Yeah. The CEO came to me and said, Rob, there's a lot of fraud on eBay. It's really hurting our company. But we aren't doing anything proactively to stop it. We need a department that is devoted to fraud prevention. And I want you to run it. I want you to start it. I want you to run it. And my initial reaction was, but I'm a lawyer. And her response was, yes, but I have confidence in you. You'll figure it out. And it was a moment where I think there was fear. A lot of times you say no to new things out of fear. Oh, it was asking me to do something that was out of my comfort zone. Asking me to do something that was outside of a world where I had been successful. Fortunately, I thought about it for a couple of days, talked to a couple of friends, and went back in and said yes. And that opportunity enabled me to build the first trust and safety platform for an internet company in Silicon Valley. And I ended up working with a tremendous group of people, really smart people in data analytics and engineers and the like. I learned a ton and ended up with just a wonderful network of folks that I never would have been exposed to had I not had some good friends who had the sense to convince me to say yes in those circumstances.
Well, I have the sense, too, that it feeds into a passion of yours, right? It's not leaving the work that you were doing. It is truly building upon the work you're doing and deepening it into sort of real human condition stuff. These are the important questions, and we so often find ourselves dealing with the unimportant questions.
That's right. Worrying about that made me more than a lawyer. And sometimes a lawyer can be a little limiting. But getting into that trust and safety world got me to think about other people and caring more than what a lot of lawyers, I think, end up doing in a very adversarial world. So it was a wonderful turning point for me in my life.
The book is called Intentional Integrity, How Smart Companies Can Lead an Ethical Revolution. Robert Chesnut, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I had a good time.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.